Centre at 7. Two people have become the first in the UK to be diagnosed with coronavirus. Public Health England is now trying to trace anyone who came into contact with the pair, who were staying at a hotel in York. They're now being treated at a specialist unit in Newcastle. Local MP Chion Wooras thinks there needs to be more support from the government.
I want to see better information, because where there's no information, people get worried. And I also want to see that we have the resources to support the potential of an outbreak, and that people can feel assured that our NHS is not going to suffer from a winter crisis.
Officials say the NHS is extremely well prepared. Boris Johnson's told cabinet members that a new chapter in the United Kingdom's story will start after 11 p.m. Britain will officially leave the European Union then, entering an 11-month transition period. There are expected to be both celebrations and protests across the UK. Tory MP Marc Francois says it's time to focus on the future.
After we've celebrated this evening, those of us that wish to, it's entirely voluntary, you know, we do need to move on. It is a sense of a new era. And hopefully we can put those old labels of Brexiteer and Remainer behind us and just go back to being Brits.
Getting Bristol home, traffic and travel.
I took the shot, and as I was walking away, motorcycle cop, he threw his bike down. He jumped off, and as he come running in a little zigzag, or whatever you want to call it, like he's really into combat or something, he's still a wide open target, anybody could shoot him. He's got his pistol out. He's running up the hill there. The two guys in the suits, they go over and they open up identifications. So I have to figure these are probably my cover that I've never been informed about. And I was told not to worry. They stopped him and he never came no farther. He went back down off the knoll.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Coronavirus. Are there going to be vaccines available straight away? How dangerous, really, is this? Epidemic or not? And the deal of the century, or is it a recipe for war, telling the Palestinians to move out of East Jerusalem? Something they say they're simply not prepared to do. We compare this week's Israel-Palestine peace deal to the 1995 Oslo Accords, which hit the buffers at Israel's biggest ever peace rally in November that year when Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin was assassinated. The man who shot him, Yigal Amir, is still in jail, but his wife, Larissa Timbola Amir, is now running for the Knesset. How's that for chutzpah? Julian Assange's French lawyer, Juan Branco, is speaking now at the Chelsea Tavern here in Easton for Bristol 24/7, a talk organised by them from 6:30 till 8:30 p.m. tonight. So, if you can't run down there right now, we have him for you too, if you couldn't make it. £5 to get in, by the way. But we're free. And as the Russians deploy their S-400 surface-to-air missiles and Putin's hypersonic missiles can target anywhere on Earth within minutes, the Pentagon has decided to move out into space with their new Space Force. And back at the 1946 Nuremberg trials, OSS lawyer William Wild Bill Donovan of UPJB fame persuaded the highest surviving Nazi leader, Hermann Göring, to turn Queen's evidence to testify publicly for days about all he knew before submitting to be executed by a firing squad rather than hanging, as the judges initially wanted. It would be a great deal, you'd have thought. But no. And the Assassin's Guide to Western Democracy, seen the Day of the Jackal, 1973, the mysterious death of US Third Army General George Patton in December 1945, how his cards were marked before D-Day even, and why Eisenhower sacked him 2 months before he died. Plus the man that confessed in the 1970s to killing him. Patton's crime, speaking his mind. And on the trail of Martin Bormann, we go to Buenos Aires in 1972 to see what local people there believed, whether he'd been found or not, and what his fate should be. our sister show Dialects here on BCFM. Tuesday at noon this week, two great local campaigns the politicians are trying to brush away. That is Bristol Against 5G and Save the M32 Maples on Lower Ashley Road. That's you can listen here at BCFM at noon next Tuesday, or download it right now from dialectradio.co.uk. But I suppose we should start, Martin, with the big news of the week. In a way, I'm glad we didn't do it last week. I felt a bit guilty afterwards for not talking about the coronavirus. But as the story is developing, it's becoming clearer and clearer that there are some people are potentially going to make a lot of money out of this.
Well, there's people potentially making a lot of money out of it, people potentially and actually dying. And of course, there's big questions about whether it's a genuinely, it's just a virus that's evolved, or whether it's got something to do with human activity. Because, of course, there are biowarfare labs in Wuhan.
Well, I mean, hang on, that's an allegation.
No, they're there. The question is whether the virus...
Okay, so what sources have you got that tell you that? Because this is being... I mean, I was just listening to the World Service was on in the kitchen today, mm-hmm. and they were saying, there is fake news being put out that there were biowarfare labs in Wuhan.
No, there's various people out there who... let's put this in context. There's been a massive swine fever epidemic in China, which has been killing off their swine herd. And we're in a very dangerous situation where the US deep state, if we can call it that, I think we're allowed to use these terms these days, has been very...
Absolutely. I mean, it's the best way of describing it. It's not just the US either.
No, yeah, but I mean, they are basically drawn the conclusion that they've got to nobble China now before China becomes too big for them to nobble.
Well, so, hasn't China become already too big for them to...
That's the point.
An incredible success. In fact, the amazing thing about China is that they've beaten the United States at capitalism, which is supposed to be the Americans' game.
Well, they're also... Under purchasing power parity, their economy is bigger than the US economy now. And this is, of course, very worrying for the US. And they've also developed very high-tech companies, which at one stage they thought they weren't going to be able to do, and they have. But, of course, the suspicion is... I mean, I think there's a Chinese admiral who's basically said that we think that we're under bio attack. And of course we know that in Cuba, for example, the US did try to introduce on many occasions viruses and other biological agents to destroy Cuban agriculture, etc. So it wouldn't at all be surprising, I'm not saying this is what's happening, it wouldn't at all be surprising if things like that were being orchestrated. But I'm not saying that they are. I mean, stuff happens anyway.
But you didn't really answer my question, did you? How do you know that there are bioweapons?
Well, I understood from things I've read that there are biowarfare labs all over the place. There's US ones based in Georgia. Yeah. Now it's something that anybody can check. The Chinese have got their biowarfare facilities just like we have.
Okay, so the original article came out in something called the Washington Times, I think it was. But the Washington Post on Wednesday this week is saying experts debunk the fringe theory. That's what they're calling your so-called facts, linking China's coronavirus to weapons research.
I understand that both Israeli and Russian experts have said that this virus has definitely been engineered to some extent. Now, I don't know enough to say whether that's true or not. I'm just saying what people are saying out there. And it's all very well posed, this has been debunked, this has been debunked. I don't believe what mainstream media say about most things. It doesn't mean that the conspiracy theories are right.
But based on the virus genome and properties, there is no indication whatsoever that it was an engineered virus, said Richard Ebright, professor of chemical biology at Rutgers University. Tim Trevin, a biological safety expert based in Maryland, said most countries had largely abandoned their bioweapons research after years of work proved fruitless.
Well, all I'm saying is stuff I've been reading, and again, it's Israeli and Russian experts are saying no, it's been modified. Now let's take a step back and look at the wider context.
Okay, I just want to bring some facts in here, because there is something called the Wuhan National Biosafety Laboratory. It opened in 2014, and it's part of the Wuhan Institute of Virology. In fact, it's one of the most important biosafety labs in the whole of China. What you're saying is that it may be linked to, you think, to military research rather than just biosafety.
All right. Well, it's, in other words, that is what we're talking about. Now, I would what I'm suggesting, Tony, and I think it's perfectly reasonable to suggest this, is that elements within Western security forces may have started both the swine fever outbreak and the coronavirus outbreak, because they've both got very big implications for the Chinese economy and the stability of the Chinese communist system.
So I suppose there is
they wouldn't do things like that. I say, yes, they would. Have they done it on this occasion? Big question. Would they do things like that? The answer is yes,
okay,
they
so
would.
So what would be the geopolitical purpose of something like that then?
Well, basically, it undermines the Chinese economy. And we know that they were doing it with Cuba. Yeah, we know with the freedom of information requests that the US deliberately introduced viruses of various kinds into Cuba to try and wreck their agricultural production. And anybody who says that they didn't do it basically is wrong. That's what definitely happened. And we know that they do things like that. And we know that they're basically talking up, Pompeo is talking up China as the biggest threat that we face, etc., etc., etc. All of which is, you know, basically softening people up for, and therefore we have to take these various steps. Well, not that we're going to say that, you know, it's all plausibly deniable. Now, I don't know whether that happened or not, because we're not at a level to know whether that kind of thing is going on or not. But would they do stuff like that? I'm afraid they would. We know they would. And if they're that if they're that scared of the Russia of the Chinese and the Russians, I mean, both China and Russia are being talked up as a major threat to Western interests, blah blah blah, and that's part of the softening up campaign for us to do the various things we need to do to bring them down. And you know, we saw the assassination of Soleimani. You wouldn't imagine that they would do anything like that, but they've done it, and that's the mentality that they have.
Well, here's a story for you. This is from Thursday, the 9th of July, 2015. The British government subjected thousands of people to chemical and biological warfare trials during the Cold War. During the Cold War, British government used the general public as unwitting biological and chemical warfare guinea pigs on a much greater scale than previously thought, according to new historical research. In more than 750 secret operations, hundreds of thousands of ordinary Britons were subjected to mock biological and chemical warfare attacks launched from aircraft, ships and road vehicles. Historians thought such operations had been less extensive. The new research carried out by Ulf Schmidt, Professor of Modern History at the University of Kent, revealed the British military aircraft dropped thousands of kilos of chemical of a largely unknown toxic potential on British civilian populations in and around Salisbury in Wiltshire, Cardington in Bedfordshire and Norwich in Norfolk. So it's just a live test on the population.
That's right. Well, I mean, the fact is, in the past, they definitely did do these kind of things. And I think they're quite capable of carrying out biological warfare against China. I don't know what the Chinese military's
his book, by the way, is called Secret Science.
Yeah. I don't know what the Chinese military's assessment of that would be, but there are you know, some outspoken Chinese military personnel in the past who've said, well, we think that we are under attack.
Is there precedent for WMD popping up next door to biological or chemical labs, isn't there? That's Salisbury.
It's bound to raise a isn't it, when you've got a top lab which deals with this stuff, whether it's military or civilian, and this is Wuhan is where this stuff breaks out. Now, it may be that it's just what people have been suggesting, it's because of the Chinese diet, and they've been eating bats and snakes, and that's why the virus has spread. But it's quite possible.
Hang on, just a second, because this surely is a conspiracy theory, isn't it? The idea that a snake is just going to kind of mutate a virus, and the virus is going to come out of a snake and go and
viruses do cross species barriers, and that's often what.
But it's a theory, is what I'm saying.
No, it's not just a theory. I mean, smallpox came from cows. We know that, you know. And this is one of the problems with the whole of agriculture when it came in the very first agricultural revolution, is that all sorts, because we were in close contact with farm animals, all sorts of major diseases developed, which have been major killers ever since. Which is why when Westerners went to Latin America, as it wasn't then, all the population died because they had no exposure to the viruses which come from farm animals. They didn't really have any farm animals.
Anyway, so whether or not we catch it, and whether it's a real epidemic here, obviously, you know, it's actually the most, almost all of the people that have been dying apparently are very elderly or otherwise ill.
Yeah.
Which I suppose you'd expect with a particularly virulent flu-like virus, and it kind of causes pneumonia, that sort of thing. But on BBC's Question Time yesterday, there was actually from a GP, I think it was in Matlock they held it, a lot of criticism from this GP of the way the mass media have been dealing with it. And you'll find that the presenter, Fiona Bruce, tries to sort of excuse the mass media coverage. But I think it's quite fair to say that there's been an element of hysteria in the coverage of it. I mean, mean, we're trying to look at lots of different angles, of course, as to what's really behind it here. But anyway, let's see what this GP had to say in Matlock last night on the BBC's Question Time.
I'm a GP locally, and with regards to the coronavirus, I think the government have done a good job. I've got a brilliant amount of information from them very, very quickly. What I think the problem is the press. I think they're scaremongering. I don't think they give the correct information.
Obviously, well, yes, hopefully Fergus, my colleague Fergus, has been doing a reasonable job. What about what the lady was saying there about everyone coming back on the plane and will they end up infecting each other?
I mean, it's an incredibly contagious form of a flu virus, essentially, and what nobody ever talks about is the military staff and the medical staff. They are likely to be carriers and going to infect people, but where are they going?
So that's BBC Question Time. One of the GPs there really criticising the coverage of it. It's easy to build up this kind of hysteria, to have a mass panic, isn't it? And to get everybody really concerned about something which may not be. But, I mean, I suppose that's because we don't necessarily know where it's going. But, I mean, she's making a good point, that GP there, about all the people that are having to deal with this are potentially being exposed. But then they will almost certainly be having these biological protection suits on.
Well, that's right. I mean, it's hard to know whether one should... You see, the thing about having this kind of high level of panic is means that you actually squash something before it gets going. I mean, that would be the logic of it. But, I mean, if you come back to the Spanish flu of 1918, that evolved in the United States on a military base where they've been carrying out experiments with carrying out vaccinations. And we've talked about this previously, Tony. There's quite a lot of evidence to suggest that that was actually a result of military meddling. And, you know, over the years, I mean, militaries all over the world have been developing stuff which will kill people. That's what militaries do. And, of course, that stuff can escape by accident, or it can be deliberately used, as it was used against the Cubans in the 50s and the 60s by the United States.
At the end of the day, though, what's the possibility that these biological research labs in Wuhan have got something to do with it? Because they clearly are there. It's just a question of whether they are really purely civilian and civil use.
Well, I mean, even whether they're civilian or military, they can also just lose control of what they're supposed to be looking after. Yeah. I mean, it's pretty scary if you think about it, that people are developing these kind of deadly viruses. Research on this requires the viruses to be developed. And, of course, they can escape. And we know in the past that states, no stronger than that, have used these mechanisms to try and achieve political goals. We know that's what the CIA used to do. They've done loads of research on it, and they've definitely used it. Whether they are responsible in this case is another matter. But if you look at the circumstances surrounding this, with the face-off between the US and China, and the US pretty determined, you know,
cutting off Hong Kong, cutting off communications with the mainland, for example.
Yeah.
Interesting, wasn't it, to see Carrie Lam, the chief executive of Hong Kong, giving a press conference in a mask where a few weeks ago she banned the use of masks.
Indeed. And in other words, there's all sorts of geopolitical tensions between China and the West which complicate an objective analysis.
But they don't
necessarily
have anything to do with this at all.
It could just be an accident. We've got, you know, you should always suspend judgment unless you know what the answer is. There's no point assuming that you know what's going on when you don't.
Okay, so let's move on now to look at the deal of the century, which is the new deal for Palestinians and the Israelis. But, yeah, I mean, I think most commentators have been quite frank about it. It does tend to favour the Israelis, Martin.
Well, it's basically the Palestinians are being just told to surrender. And if they surrender, then the Gulf states, which are our other major allies, will cough up some money so that they can be some of their people can be given a reasonable lifestyle. But it's totally unacceptable to them, and unacceptable to most people in the Middle East, in fact.
Okay, so we've got a 9-minute report now, which is from both sides, from the BBC's World Update on the World Service, which really looking at what the effect of this is going to be and what the opinions are of both the Israeli and the Palestinian sides of the new peace deal.
This is a plan that's very important to peace in the Middle East. No matter where I went, they say Israel and the Palestinians, they have to make peace before you can really have peace in the Middle East. So people have been working on this for many, many years, and I think we're relatively close, but we have to get other people to agree with it also. I will say many of the Arab nations have agreed to it. They like it. They think it's great. They think it's a big start. I think it's a big start, too. I think it's a fantastic thing if we can pull it off.
Mr. President, I just want to say two things. First, that the deal of the century is the opportunity of a century, and we're not going to pass it by. Today, I repeat, I just want to say thank you for everything you've done for the state of Israel. You've been the greatest friend that Israel has had in the White House, and I think tomorrow we can continue making history.
Well, let's hear now from Yaakov Amador, former National Security Advisor to the Prime Minister of Israel. He's been speaking to the BBC's Nick Robinson about what's known about the plan so far.
As far as we know, the deal includes an independent Palestinian state, and if it will be adapted by the Israelis, by the Knesset or by the government, it will be the first time that formally Israel is adapting such solution, which was not mentioned in Oslo Accord at all. So from one side, it's easier for Israel because it's taking into account more needs of Israel relating to security, but at the same time, it's giving formally the Palestinians a state.
But do you believe that that state will be what they, the Palestinians, want, or a state that has large parts of the West Bank carved out for Israeli settlements?
No, it will not be the state that the Palestinians want. The state the Palestinians want does not include Israel at all. They want a Palestine all over, from the Mediterranean into the Jordan River. As always, the Palestinians say no before they know the details of the plan. Never in the history the Palestinians agreed to negotiate with the Israelis based on any offer by us or by the Americans.
But Mr. Amador, the Palestinians have been willing to recognize Israel, many of them. What is the point now of coming up with a plan that they've not been involved in drawing up?
I don't know what is the reason, you know, where those who do not like Trump says it's politics. Those who like Trump say he is making the most important historian offer. The question is not why he did it. The most important one, will the two sides will be smart enough to sit and negotiate based on this offer and to get something which is better than not having an agreement? What's important for Israel is that the first time in a plan which was offered not by Israel but by foreign leader, the security needs of Israel are more on the table and had been taken into account in the plan, something which was not in the previous offers by President Obama and President Clinton. We don't know what will happen in the future. The fact that there is on the shelf few plans by American presidents, here we have an offer in which Israel will have much more capabilities to defend itself in any negotiation in the future, any situation in the future in which will be negotiation. So historically, it's very important.
In other words, you think its significance is that it will be published, put on a shelf, rather than that it will trigger a change in what is happening in the Middle East at the moment?
The fact that the Palestinians do not accept an American offer, an American paper, it's not a new phenomenon. It's very old. It's happened to Clinton, it's happened to Obama, and now it's happening to Trump. And all the offers at the end of the day remained on the shelf. So this also will go to the shelf and may be used in the future, I don't know.
Yaakov Amador, former National Security Advisor to Israel's Prime Minister, speaking to Nick Robinson. Well, then I spoke to Hossam Zamlot, who is the Palestinian ambassador to London. I asked him why Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas has rejected the Trump White House proposals even before they've been released.
I mean, there is enough details and it's all over the place. This has nothing to do with a deal or a plan, and definitely has nothing to do with peace. It's fraud on the timing. I mean, it's not a coincidence that today, exactly today, there is a Knesset discussion against Netanyahu about his criminal charges. It's not a coincidence that there is the impeachment hearing also today about President Trump in the Senate. It's fraud on the content. We don't need to know what's in it. We already know what's not in it. And this is what President Trump himself said. Jerusalem is off the table. Refugees are off the table. Settlements are all of a sudden not in contradiction with international law, that Israel must retain major territories of what left of historic Palestine, which is the 22%. So what's not in it is enough of information for us to know about this deal. And it's fraud on the process also. I mean, this is a process of negotiation between Israelis and Israelis. I mean, you saw the head of the government and the head of the opposition next to President Trump. And right from the beginning, they decided to push the Palestinians out. And they closed our office. You know, I was the head of the PLO office, the Palestinian mission in Washington. And they shuttered down our mission right at the height of our engagement with them. So they are not interested.
Exactly. Everybody would understand why you say what you've just said, but how to get from there to something. At the moment, there is nothing on the table. This is some opportunity to get round a table, negotiate, say, we don't like that bit, but okay, that bit we could talk about, but you're just not talking.
No, but we did that. It's been a long process. We've been negotiating for 30 years. We did that because we accepted the international logic. The international community decided that a solution will be found on the basis of the two states on the 1967 borders. Palestine will be a sovereign independent state on the land that Israel occupied in 1967, with East Jerusalem being an occupied city, the capital of the state of Palestine. That's not me who decided or us. That's the United States, the United Kingdom, the Security Council. We are not for sale. This isn't, you know, a company-to-company relationship. This isn't real estate business in New York, and this isn't show business.
Yes, but you're dealing with Donald Trump, and who may be there for another 6 years. You were in Washington, as you say, you were the head of the mission there. You must have known all this was coming. You left, what, just over a year ago. So did you get any chance to talk to Jared Kushner, for example, who's leading this initiative?
You know, I think the Palestinian-American relationship in the year 2017, just the beginning of the Trump administration, was one of the best in the world. Our president met President Trump four times in a matter of few weeks between May 2017 and September 2017. I mean, and every time we meet President Trump, it was positive, it was promising, it was hopeful. I myself, among the Palestinian officials, have met Jared Kushner and Jason Greenblatt numerous times. We lost count, but more than 32 times. So
they weren't listening to what you said?
No, it was at the peak of the relationship. And I was sent after President Trump was inaugurated to engage directly. So we availed ourselves immediately. Right at the peak of that moment, I received a phone call from the State Department in November 2017, before anything, that our mission in Washington is to be closed. You tell me, if you really want the Palestinians on the table, and if you really want to talk to the Palestinians, you close their mission?
So what went wrong then? Because you were having these conversations with Jared Kushner and others, and yet they told you, clear off,
yes,
in effect.
Yes, exactly. Because
so who do you blame?
I blame those who want this to be about show business. About the personal vested interest of the two men involved, that is Netanyahu. It's a lifeline for him. And that is Trump. It's another lifeline for him at our expense and at the expense of international order, international legality. I blame also those who think we Palestinians are the weakest link. We might not have an army. We don't have an army. We don't have oil. We don't have much, but we have us. We have us. We have the Palestinian people. I mean, we are not alone. And everybody who come close to this reality realizes that the hope in the hearts of the millions of Palestinians will get us where we want to go. This is a bad moment. It's Netanyahu's moment, the far-right elements of the world moment under the sun. It's not our moment. But we are comfortable to be allied with international law, international legitimacy, international logic. We are comfortable to be allied with liberal values, with democratic values, even though if they don't have loudspeaker right now, there will come a time. So it's not all about Trump. Let him have his moment, but we will not accept the logic that we are simply the victims of their show business about their re-elections.
Hassan Samlot, Palestinian ambassador to London.
We've got a lot to crack through, Martin. So before we talk about that, let's have a listen to Prime Minister's questions this week, where Jeremy Corbyn brought this whole topic up with Boris Johnson.
The US Secretary of State is visiting later today. President Trump's latest Middle East peace plan is not a peace plan. It will annex Palestinian territory, lock in illegal Israeli colonization, transfer Palestinian citizens of Israel, and deny Palestinian people their fundamental rights. When the government meets with the US Secretary of State later today, will he make it clear that the British government will stand for a genuine, internationally backed peace plan rather than this stuff proposed by Trump yesterday?
Well, Mr. Speaker, let me first of all say, in memory of Nicholas Parsons, I think we should all avoid hesitation, deviation, or repetition in this House. And let's be clear, this is a problem that has bedeviled the world for decades, and the Middle East, of course, in particular. No peace plan is perfect, but this has the merit of a two-state solution. It is a two-state solution. It would ensure that Jerusalem is both the capital of Israel and of the Palestinian people. And I urge him, rather than being so characteristically negative, to reach out to his friends, my friends, our friends in the Palestinian Authority, to Mahmoud Abbas, for whom I have the highest respect, and urge him for once to engage with this initiative, to get talking rather than to leave a political vacuum.
Martin, the main message coming out of this is everyone is saying to the Palestinians, come on, get around the table, even if it's not a great deal now, you can make it great.
Well, I mean, they're perfectly within their rights to say you can't bully us around. They're not going to accept that. Why would they?
The way this has gone down in Israel is always very interesting. And apparently Trump's peace plan has failed to boost the Likud ahead of the elections. And this is all happening, as the Palestinian ambassador said there, the same time as there's a lot of decisions being made in the Knesset about whether or not to prosecute Netanyahu, which is all rather handy for Bibi.
Well, I'm sure there is an element of that going on, because the diplomacy by Kushner and others is very much personal diplomacy, family to family, as it were. But I mean,
Jimmy Carter has come out today saying that this plan violates international law.
That's right. I mean, Benny.
Does it? Does it, do you think?
Yes, of course it does. It's basically rewarding land grabbing. And the danger of repeating myself, we went to war with Serbia in the 1990s to prevent land grabbing. We didn't have sanctions on them. We did have sanctions on them, but we also killed a lot of people to make sure that they couldn't have Kosovo, they couldn't have Bosnia, they couldn't have chunks of Croatia.
What about these comparisons to Oslo? We heard the Israeli interviewee there saying, well, actually, this deal is better than Oslo.
Well, what that spin, because basically he's saying we're recognising a state, and they agreed to recognise a Palestinian state at Oslo. So him saying that there's a state in here somewhere and therefore we're not happy with it is a way of spinning it to make it sound as if it's not as comprehensively in favour of the Israelis as it actually is. And, you know, basically this is a totally one-sided deal. You'd have thought that, you know, if you're doing any kind of deal, you ought to be talking to the Palestinians. I mean, closing down the PL office in Washington sends a pretty clear message to the Palestinian street, doesn't it? You don't want to hear from us. And basically, Palestine is effectively in a state of war with Israel. And, of course, not being pacifists, Tony, that's what it means. And there's a price to be paid when you make those decisions, isn't
there? Okay, well, the playwright, J.T. Rogers, has written a play called Oslo, which has been touring right the way around the world, where he looks at the impact of Oslo and the Rabin assassination. And here he is now talking to the World Service. That's the playwright J.T. Rogers.
The Oslo breakthrough, we'll call it, including the signing of the paperwork on the famous Rose Garden ceremony that Clinton oversaw. Two things happened. One, the fact that it became a hard, hard slog as opposed to voila, everything's done, was a great disappointment, even though it was the truth to people. And the other is, quite frankly, that the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin is probably the most effective political assassination of the second half of the 20th century in terms of actually changing the trajectory of a nation.
Yes, that's right. And of course, there's always going to be questions about whether the deep state in Israel was involved in the assassination. At the time, Ariel Sharon wanted to come to the funeral of Yitzhak Rabin, but his wife, Leah Rabin, refused to let him come because she's pretty certain that he had a finger in it. In other words, that political assassination wasn't just carried out by an individual. It was part of being the only democratic country in the Middle East where the Prime Minister is assassinated by his own security forces.
Well, I mean, Anton Chaitkin talks about the B'nai B'rith in the United States, people having to be ejected in the early 1990s from B'nai B'rith for suggesting that one of the perfectly reasonable Zionist tactics should be to kill Jews as part of their program in order to create a threat.
They've been doing it all the time. They've been doing it for years. And if you think about it, most nationalist movements do kill their own in order to keep, you know, informers and what have you. I mean, during the armed struggle against British rule in Palestine, the Irgun and the Haganah quite happily killed Jews in order to safeguard their own infrastructure.
After he was killed, there was a general election, I think it was in the April or May after that, and there were a whole load of bombs in Tel Aviv and in Jerusalem, as I remember. But nobody quite knew who had planted them. The obvious thing is that it was the PLO, but that wasn't necessarily the case.
It wouldn't have been the PLO. It was Hamas, I believe, at the time. I mean, we'd have to go back and look at the detail of that period. The fact is that the Israel is a very, very... it's not really a democracy.
And I mean, course, most of the senior people in the government are straight from the terrorist groups that initially founded Israel.
Indeed.
And then from the special forces.
There's no reason why terrorists can't be statespeople. But on the other hand, let's not kid ourselves how the state of Israel was created. It was created through fear, violence and terror. And as many states are, most states are. So it's, in that sense, it's no different from any other.
And 1948 vote.
Let's not kid ourselves about what it is.
And a 1948 vote at the United Nations too.
Well, that's right, and they were given basically at the time they were given an agreed area which would become the Jewish state, and they've never taken any notice of that at all. Just like Serbia didn't take any notice of the internal boundaries in Yugoslavia when Serbians believed Kosovo to be theirs because that's where their Serbian civilization had been created, according to the right wing in Serbia.
A Labour member of the Knesset in Israel has called for banning Mishpat Tetzek, a political party founded to advocate for the freedom for Yitzhak Rabin's assassin. His Yigal Amir, who was the assassin, who's now in jail, his wife is running for the Knesset. A political party established by the wife of Prime Ministerial assassin Yigal Amir should not be barred from running for Knesset, the Attorney General Avichai Mandelblit told the Central Elections Committee on Tuesday this week. Amir assassinated Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin at a peace rally 24 years ago. Mandelblit was responding to a petition by Labour member of the Knesset Itzik Shmuli to ban the Mitzak Tejek, which is a fair trial. So the idea of the party is that they're saying that her husband didn't get a fair trial, and she's starting a whole political movement over it.
Well, that's what I mean. Jonathan Pollard, I believe, has been released in the United States. Perhaps you got the online there. You might be able to check that.
One of the big disputes for
the Israelis inside the U.S. military.
One of the big disputes over in Israel at the moment is that every party allowed to run in Israeli election receives taxpayer-funded radio and television advertising time. A situation some have said is unacceptable for those linked to Amir, the assassin of the Prime Minister.
Well, I think there's arguments to both ways on that. There's a free speech argument, let them say what they like. They certainly shouldn't be releasing him, absolutely not. And I think Pollard shouldn't have been released in the US. If he has been released, we need to check that. But the Israelis have been lobbying for years for him to be released, even though he sold the US nuclear secrets to the Israelis, which then they passed on to the then Soviet Union, and he was caught. But you can't, you know, there's all sorts of evil forces at work here, and it's not going to lead to peace.
Well, one of those people who's done a great deal to lead to peace is Julian Assange, who's the publisher, the editor and whistleblower and of WikiLeaks and a journalist. So his lawyer, Juan Branco, is right down at the Chelsea right now, apparently, speaking as part of the programme organised by Bristol 24/7. But I thought let's have a listen to him, where he's coming from, really. A few minutes from Juan Branco speaking at the Web Summit in Lisbon 2 months ago. And this is a massive or a very expensive thing to go to. But he was making some, I thought, really fascinating points about, what is going on with journalism on the internet, particularly.
First, I would like to thank the Web Summit for reminding us that Tony Blair is free of movement. He was here a few hours ago, in spite of having triggered a deadly war in Iraq, who has costed tens of thousands of people alive, and that in the same time, Julian Assange is still in prison in London for having revealed the crimes committed by the US and the UK. I'm not used to be surrounded by so many war criminals, so it's kind of a new setup for me. But actually, my thanks to the Web Summit are sincere in the sense that it allows really to show that Tony Blair is free of movement. And it's good to be to see it and not just to forget about that. And it allows to show that Julian is not present here, whilst I think many of you would like to hear his thoughts about this subject. He has worked a lot on commercial trade, revealing the secret commercial agreements, the CETA and so forth, and showing how they were secretly negotiated in order to favor a certain number of interests and, of course, go against many others. And yes, I've defended many people in France, yellow jackets, who have seen their lives destroyed because there was an ideology which was not sustained by fact on trade, on free trade, on the freedom of trade, which was supposed to bring a greater good at some point for humanity, but that in the meantime, could destroy the planet, could destroy thousands of lives that could not be taken back to where they were before, and that this was only perceived at an economic perspective. So a life from an economic perspective is something that will be substituted at some point, because you will get a new kid raised and he will replace the person who has been destroyed. And so, I mean, you can destroy lives for generations. Schumpeter described that, and nothing will happen from a statistic perspective. It's not the case in reality, of course. And defending those people has been very important to open the eyes regarding this situation. And, I mean, Macron had prepared a helicopter to fly away his palace the beginning of December, because there was such an anger in France against these elites which were completely indifferent to the consequences of their decisions, that they were ready to invest the Elysium. And still Macron is today in China negotiating to open even more the borders in a commercial way with China, between China and France. And he's pushing, and he has stated it publicly, especially to have more pork, French pork, being sold to China, 10,000 kilometers away. I mean, one of the main goals today of a president that pretends to be modern, to pretend to be ecological, is to try to have pork being done in France, raised in France, then put in a condition that will be able to travel 10,000 kilometers and sold to Chinese people. It makes literally no sense. And this absurdity, this complete absurdity and disconnection of these individuals who are leading us today, who are pushing us to an abyss because it's destroying the planet and destroying the individuals who are today trying to struggle for life, I mean, I think it's very well exemplified by this current situation and the fact that they do not realize. I don't even understand how Macron, while seeing Xi Jinping, doesn't ask himself when he starts talking about pork, but how can I think of bringing French pork to China? What's the meaning of this? How did I make of this not only a goal in my negotiations, but also how did I do public statements to show how important what I was doing was for the French people? How disconnected they can be, I don't know. What I know is that these tensions which are created by this world order which is falling apart will probably trigger extremely harsh consequences. And it's very easy. I saw Tony Blair again speaking about populism and complaining about populism. I don't know what populism is. I just know that there is a rage that is rising. And of course, it's not well represented here, because basically the world of technology is benefiting massively from a financial perspective, but I don't think from an ethical, nor even in terms of inventivity perspective, of this globalization. But you have millions of people who are being basically enslaved or used as consumers of these products that are imposed to them.
So, Martin, he's talking there about the world order falling apart. I suppose what he really means is the rule of law breaking down. But he's also talking about Assange, obviously, and saying, well, you know, you've got Tony Blair here at this conference, the Web Summit, but no Julian Assange. He's behind bars in Belmarsh.
Well, that's right. And I think, you know, there are wider issues, that are things that are going wrong in the world. And then there's the specific injustice being meted out to Julian Assange, which is quite extraordinary if you think about it. is that he's being, up to recently, being held in solitary confinement for things which aren't even crimes in this country.
Well, I say that this is an interesting point, isn't it? Justice for Assange, writes Nozomi Halisi on antiwar.com. Belmarsh prisoners remind us of our duty, he says, mm-hmm. because apparently the prisoners in Belmarsh have played a part in making sure that Julian Assange has not been put in solitary confinement.
Well, I used that very point when I was on RT earlier in the week. But the other thing that's very interesting that's coming out is that the US lawyers are seeming to argue that freedom of speech in the US Constitution only applies to US citizens, and that anybody else who is not a US citizen has no right to freedom of speech, not in the United States and not anywhere else. All of which is a very, very perverse interpretation of the Constitution of the United States. But that's what they seem to be arguing. And it basically means that anybody who's not an American citizen has no right to freedom of speech at all.
It even means
Americans
more than that.
Let you have one.
It even means more than that, actually, because he's placed under special measures, as the U.S. Legal team are suggesting, special administrative measures, if he's extradited, that would strip him of his right to speak at all in the United States, either to the public, the press, or his legal team, even.
That's right. So, in other words,
he's going to be like a Guantanamo prisoner or something.
Well, yeah, but in other words, the rule of law is being systematically flouted here by a crypto-fascist deep state. And what's extraordinary is that most mainstream liberal opinion in this country is walking by on the other side of the road. Although I was glad to see that John McDonnell, if you remember who he was, some guy who was involved in an election or something not long ago, will be speaking at a support meeting for Assange in London next week.
So, there's a chap called Nils Meltzer, the UN Special Rapporteur on Torture. He described Western government's abuse of power with regard to Assange like this. He said, in 20 years of working with war victims, violence and political persecution, I've never seen a group of democratic states unite to deliberately isolate, demonise and abuse a single individual for so long a time and with such little respect for human dignity and rights as Julian Assange's collective persecution must end here and must end now. He said that in May last year.
Well, he's also speaking next week at this meeting, McDonald's speaking. What I would argue is when Assange is acquitted, as he should be, by a jury in this country, he should then sue the British government for damages. And I would suggest that the British government should then, well, I don't want to pay taxes for that damages to be paid. The people who made the decision to prosecute Assange, they should pay the price, either financially or they should be sent to prison. And that sounds as if it's kind of extreme and undoable, but I think there is either a rule of law or there's not. And just as they've tried to single out Assange, we need to single them out and make sure they pay the price.
Well, they're
exactly
not going to let him
way.
Out for that precise reason, surely. Now they've boxed themselves into a corner. By committing this injustice, they're going to say, well, Assange, we're just going to lock him up and throw away the key.
Well, that's what they're going to try and do, and I think the answer to that from progressive-minded people is that, no, we're going to lock up you up and throw away the key, because the other alternative is the war alternative, where we don't have a law, we just fight. And, of course, that's happened in this country for many years in Northern Ireland and elsewhere.
Okay, talking about the law, back in the 1946 Nuremberg trials, the OSS lawyer, it's the Office for Strategic Services, so the predecessor of the CIA, William Wild Bill Donovan, actually persuaded the highest surviving Nazi leader, Hermann Göring, to turn Queen's evidence, to testify publicly. So this is in a documentary about the life of Wild Bill Donovan.
While Jackson is in England trying to get the ground rules straight, Donovan
for Nuremberg
interviews Hermann Göring.
It's amazing, two guys from Western New York working on such an enormous thing.
He talks to Göring. Göring says, I'll testify against five or six Nazis. All I want is not to be hung. You give me a firing squad. Donovan's response was, dead is dead. And he said, if that's what you want, we can do that, if that's what it takes to flip you. Well, it turned out that the people who were very close to Jackson said, he had no right to be doing that, and they didn't like that. Jackson, who was a careful lawyer, said we have enough books and records and information to do this. Donovan, who was a theatrical trial lawyer, said, my God, nothing that we have can come near what we can accomplish by putting a live person on to talk about these other folks. And Jackson simply didn't want to do business with that kind of person.
The difference of opinion between the two men created a chasm that couldn't be crossed. Jackson, careful and deliberate, didn't back down, and Donovan, proud and opinionated, resigned from the prosecution.
So that's an interesting little exchange, isn't it? Back in 1946, Martin, as Donovan is talking to Hermann Göring, Göring's saying, well, I'll go on the witness stand and I'll testify against all the other top Nazis, and yet he's told, no, we're not going to do that, we're just going to hang you.
Well, I mean, that's what the debate was going on within the, you know, Western power structure at that time. And that's what was going on, as you say.
Well, but, I mean, surely you would have thought that if there was any justice to those trials, that would have been incredibly valuable information. And, in fact, if Göring had been stood up at the witness box for several days talking about the war, we would have found out a hell of a lot more about, potentially, about cooperation with the Allies, for example.
Well, as you know, basically, people at Nuremberg were scapegoated, and others, like Martin Bormann, who's your favourite person, were rescued and looked after. So, it was victor's justice without a shadow of a doubt, although I see that one of the Nuremberg prosecutors has also condemned the assassination of Soleimani, saying that, if you do stuff like that, you're in defiance of international law. There's no doubt about it that the Western intelligence services are well in defiance of international law. They should be going to prison, Brigadier Gordon Kerr, for example, in this country.
In the year before...
Where is he now?
In the year before the Nuremberg trials, 1945, the year the Second World War ended... it was General Patton. Can you just say something a bit about him? Because he was became quite a famous, well-known general, commanded the Third Army. I think it was on the southern flank of the Western Front.
Well, I mean, I'm not quite sure what you're going to come out with now about Patton, but Patton was basically a political general. He was one of those generals that played to the gallery. And it was a very interesting BBC Two documentary about the Battle of the Bulge, which I watched some years ago. And Patton was pushing that instead of putting a left hook through the Low Countries, the Arnhem attack, etc., the Market Garden, which is what Montgomery wanted to do, he pushed for the US Army to have its own show further south, and Eisenhower basically had to mediate between Monty and Patton, and he came down in favour of giving Patton more resources and Monty less, which of course meant Market Garden failed for other reasons as well, but also the Germans were coming too far too fast, and the Americans were coming too far too fast, and the Germans counterattacked at the Battle of the Bulge. All Patton's fault.
So anyway,
because Patton just wanted to be first into Germany.
As I said, Patton's cards were marked way back in April 1944, a couple of months before the D-Day invasion. Apparently he disobeyed Eisenhower's orders not to make speeches or public appearances without permission, and accepted an invitation as the principal guest at the inauguration of something called the Welcome Club, which had been established by the villagers of Knutsford, close to Patton's headquarters for American servicemen. He was assured he would be there unofficially and there would be no ceremony, but when he arrived, he discovered, to his dismay, there were a crowd, a brass band, an honour guard of British women auxiliaries to welcome him, and a number of press photographers. Patton requested no photographs of him be taken, and the photographers agreed. Told that there were no reporters present, he then proceeded to make a few bellicose remarks, among them the declaration that since it is the evident destiny of the British and Americans to rule the world, the better we get to know each other, the better job we'll do. So apparently he was ticked off for that. But that remark, an insult to Russia, was quickly splashed across the headlines of the world press, but it never came out in Britain itself, interestingly.
Well, it was wartime censorship.
It was a censorship during the war, yeah. Anyway, so it went on to D-Day, and Patton was relieved of his command on the 7th of October after making a statement publicly that America had been fighting the wrong enemy, Germany, instead of Russia.
But I want you to remember that the sacrifice that these men have made must not be in vain. This war, as I said, is only half won.
well, this is why he was a loose cannon, and that's that. And basically, it was his fault that the Battle of the Bulge occurred. The Battle of the Bulge was a massive mess up, and it was Patton's fault. They should have done what Monty wanted to do, which is put all the forces up in the north and to enter Germany through the Low Countries. Patton wasn't accepting that, and basically that's what led to the Battle of the Bulge, and then extended the war by some months as a result.
So Patton was relieved of his command on the 7th of October and had an accident on the 8th of December. By the 21st of December, he was dead, 1945, just before the opening of 1946.
Well, along with a lot of other people. So, you know, generals going to expect to be killed, can't they?
Douglas
As DeWitt. Machiavelli said, don't be a successful general or even an unsuccessful one.
Douglas DeWitt Bazzato, who served with the US Office of Strategic Services behind enemy lines in France in World War II, died in July, on July the 14th in Chevy Chase, is that Maryland? He was 88, but he was reported by the New York Times. But he actually confessed to killing. This is back in 1999, to actually killing Patton. That's, you know, quite not really very well known as far as I certainly didn't know anything about it, but that's I thought quite strange that isn't all that well known. Anyhow, let's move on to our final item, which is about the Buenos Aires Vox Pops on Bormann. And I found this quite amazing that Martin Bormann, and we're doing lots on the end of the Second World War, because, of course, this is the time a lot of people who are dying have said, right, I want to tell my tale now about what happened in World War II. And these are some Vox Pops from 1972 by people living in Buenos Aires about the discovery of Martin Bormann, Hitler's private secretary, living there.
Do you think that Bormann is really alive and living prosperously in South America?
I think that it's quite possible that the story is true. I think that it's quite probable that if it's true, that is it either in Argentina or in Paraguay. We more or less suspected that for years and years and years.
Now, what do you think should happen now? Do you think the Israelis should bring him back to Israel for trial, or what do you think should happen to him?
Well, if he's alive, I think that he should be brought to trial. But I don't think he should be brought to trial here. I think he should be brought to trial in Germany or something like that.
Didn't you give some of the details that are contained in the present account?
Certainly. I published the story about this phony name, Eliezer Goldstein, which he was using when he was living in Brazil, this passport of a dead Jew. And I wrote also about all the way by which he transferred all this money to South America, all those checks which were sent to the name of Perón, Eva Perón, the submarines, which brought quite a lot of Nazi booty and loot from the museums and banks of Europe to South America, which helped Martin Bormann to escape.
We have to kidnap him and to bring him and to make a trial.
And what do you think should happen to him then? Do you think he should be executed?
Yeah.
You definitely think he should die?
Yeah, sure, absolutely.
Do you think the man deserves to live?
No, he should not live. He should pay, everybody should pay for his crime.
He made for dying for so many people, so he had to die also.
Anyway, that's the reports from 1972. Of course, we don't hear much about that now, but something from the archives, a passport of a dead Jew that Martin Bormann had, apparently, and that was some of the evidence that was used to get him. Okay, well, they nearly got him, but he got away. So, time to sign off for the US-owned Comcast News at 8. Coming up is Mohammed Makami. We hope you'll find this show's podcast, story links and comment page and our contact details out this week, oneword.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Have a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend. Do join us for the politics show at 6 o'clock next week. God bless. And don't let the banksters get you down.